This is PCJ Radio. Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Hello and welcome to the program. It's nice to have you back with us once again. On this edition, we're going to be joined by Richard Cuff, one of the organizers of the SWL, that's Shortwave Listeners Fest, which is going to be happening in a place called Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, March 4th and 5th.
We'll also be joined by Wendell Menick, a U.S.-based journalist in Taiwan, to talk about a unique station that calls out numbers. Yes, a spy number station.
As well as Canada's Minister of Industry, Tony Clement will join us to talk about the battle Canada's federal government is having with its licensing agency and the federal courts over telecommunications newcomer to the Canadian market.
We'll also have an editorial on the shortwave cuts at the BBC World Service and the Voice of America.
But first, here's Paulette with a look at some of the major news stories making headlines in the world of media. Paulette?
Well, as you know, the Middle East has been in the headlines lately. With the resignation of the Tunisian president and Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak, lots of attention has been placed on media from this region. At the start of the protest in Egypt, the authorities blocked off internet service and cut mobile phone service in the country to prevent information from getting to the population. The only source in Egypt was the official state media. Since the recording of this show on February 23rd, Libya has seen the number in protests increase. On February 21st, Al Jazeera accused Libya's intelligence services of jamming its broadcast in the country where demonstrators have been protesting against the regime. The Qatar-based network said it was able to determine the source of the jamming of its broadcasts, which began on February 2nd and continued intermittently, but coincided with the channel's broadcasts on Libya. In a statement, Al Jazeera said the jamming originated south of the capital of Tripoli from a Libyan intelligence technical administration building headed by a general. The building was located in front of Salah ad-Din Hospital in an area of the same name in Al-Khadra al-Hadba district, it said, adding it made this conclusion from accurate studies carried out by specialized companies. Al Jazeera channels have been subject to jamming for weeks, with an increase since Friday, February 18th. The Pan-Arab Television Network has announced broadcasts on new frequencies from satellite operators Nilesat, Arabsat, and Hotbird from Europe to cope with the problem. It also accused Libyan authorities of blocking its website throughout the country. North Korea has suspended rental of mobile phones to foreign visitors since January, visitors to the country said Monday, a move that may reflect concern in the North over the flow of information about democracy demonstrations sweeping the Middle East. But some visitors quoted North Korean officials as saying the country unofficially decided to suspend the service late last year because of a change in the communication system. As of Monday, North Korea's official media has yet to report on the situation in the Middle East, including the overthrow of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Pyongyang is believed to be wary of the inflow and circulation of information from abroad that may lead to a call for regime change in the country, prompting speculation the suspension of the mobile phone rental service may last for a long time. North Korea bans foreign visitors, including diplomats, from bringing mobile phones into the country. Bulgaria's Focus radio network is to broadcast four news bulletins a day in English from Washington as of February 21st. The bulletins for Bulgaria will be aired at 10:30 a.m., 2:30 p.m., 6:30 p.m., and 10:30 p.m. local time, and will be prepared by Voice of America. Broadcasting news bulletins in English is in compliance with a contract between Focus News Agency and the Broadcasting Board of Governors. The target group of the English news bulletins of Focused Radio is Bulgarian citizens and all foreign nationals and institutions staying or working in Bulgaria. The top international pieces of news from Washington will be aired in the news bulletins in Bulgarian. The UK's broadcast minister, Ed Vasey, has confirmed to a group of MPs that the FM wave band will not be switched off in 2015 and will remain as one of a number of multi-platform transmission options for local commercial radio. He also confirmed that he was prepared to take a look at the recent decision by Ofcom to limit license renewal terms for local commercial stations to just 7 years. And finally, an editorial on the China Daily website, the largest English portal in China, has welcomed the decision of the BBC and Voice of America to end their radio broadcasts in Chinese. The editorial says, "The cuts in the major Western media organizations' Chinese language services will not have much of an impact on Chinese people because now they have multimedia channels for information and entertainment, both with domestic and international content. So when the two media giants stop broadcasting their services in Putonghua, the farewell will not be bitter. Besides, the global trend of a decline in traditional media has in recent years made radio and TV a much less significant source of information for people. Surveys show that the number of shortwave radio listeners has declined in most regions of China." China Daily explains to its readers that the decisions can be blamed squarely on lack of funds and calls this understandable. But it then goes on to say, "The BBC and VOA have been reaching out to Chinese for years as part of the Western publicity strategy. Overall, they serve as a carrier of Western values and the Western concept of democracy. Instead of bridging the gap of information and understanding between peoples, very often their biased programs have created misunderstanding between the West and the East."
Well, I can say one thing, actually, that story in the China Daily doesn't surprise me that they would say that. But anyway, thanks goes to Andy Sennett at Radio Netherlands Worldwide for the material used. If you would like to read the Radio Netherlands Media Network blog, just go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the link. If you want more information about what's going on in the world of international broadcasting, do check out Shortwave America by Dan Hensley, and you can find that link at the Media Network Plus page at PCJ Media.
As we just heard, the government mouthpiece in China, the China Daily, welcomes the cuts to the BBC World Service and the proposed cuts to the Voice of America to eliminate Chinese to China. Now, Keith, you've been paying close attention to this subject.
Yes, I have. Since the last edition of Media Network Plus, there were a couple of big stories that happened that we couldn't get into the January edition. One of the stories broke 2 days after we had produced the last program, and that was the big budget cuts that will be happening at the BBC World Service. Now, some of the cuts I do understand, and I'm all for restructuring and making an organization more efficient. In the area where I have, question marks and light bulbs going off in my head and alarm bells ringing, more than normally, is the cutting of the Chinese service to China on shortwave. It completely mystifies me why the BBC World Service would make these cuts. On January 26th, British MP Louise Bagshaw was invited on the program NewsHour with John Cusett, a former director of the BBC. The host of the program is Claire Balderson, and this is what she had to say.
You're listening to NewsHour with Claire Balderson, and we were just hearing about the budget cuts at the BBC imposed because the grant in aid from the Foreign Office that'll fund the World Service for the next 3 years has been reduced significantly. Well, John Chuser is a former head of the World Service. First, though, Louise Bagshaw. She's a Conservative Member of Parliament's Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee. Why is the BBC World Service having to take a disproportionate hit in the cuts imposed on the Foreign Office budget?
I don't think it is. Again, you just heard from Peter Horrocks. I thought it was a very sensible answer that the BBC has to look at priorities. In fact, what's been handed to the BBC World Service is levels of spending that they received in 2007 to 2008. So we're not talking about a doomsday scenario. What we are talking about is setting strategic priorities, reducing, for example, you put it that we're cutting radio services to Russia and we're cutting them to China. What we didn't explain there is that China very often blocks off those shortwave services, so they're not actually reaching an audience, and that in Russia shortwave use is declining massively and people are turning to the internet. I think we had the implication there that the BBC World Service suggested further languages to be shut, but the Foreign Secretary has given approval to these particular ones, and as we've heard, there are changing strategic priorities. The BBC World Service provides a voice in the wilderness for people that can't otherwise get free news. Where that situation has changed, as it has in the Balkans, surely that's a place for cutting, where it reaches small audiences.
It hasn't changed. changed in China. In Russia, one could argue, it hasn't changed. In Cuba, where there's a small Spanish for Cuba service. So what are the strategic priorities?
But in China, as I have just said, the Chinese government regularly blocks shortwave radio
broadcasts
by the World Service. No, we're trying to provide it in a more effective way. If you turn more to the internet, people are much more Yes, but they're more likely to be able to access that than blocked shortwave services, which is exactly what the Chinese government is doing.
What about the argument that is often made very effectively, that the World Service is a very good tool of soft power for Britain? And it seems a little perverse that the overseas aid budget is protected from the spending cuts, but the World Service budget isn't protected in any way.
No, I think the Foreign Secretary has said that the BBC World Service remains a priority for the soft power that you talk about. He is about to announce an extra £10 million per annum to be given to the World Service to concentrate on the new strategic priorities, programming in Urdu, programming in Hindi, and programming in sub-Saharan Africa. So the Foreign Office is still very much alive to the strategic value of the World Service for those soft power objectives.
OK, I'm going to bring in here John Tewser, former head of the World Service. What's your reaction, John Tewser, to what you've heard today about the extent of the cuts?
Well, first of all, I think that I feel huge sympathy for Peter Horrocks. He's been put in an impossible situation. The Foreign Office didn't fight for him. They loaded the heaviest cuts on him under the World Service. I've always said the Foreign Office were poor custodians of the World Service. This is now being proved right. The BBC Trust didn't fight. And the result is it's a bad day for World Service audiences, for British foreign policy, because how on earth you can maintain the budget for international development and then cut one of the most powerful instruments of international development, which is the World Service, simply beggars the imagination. And the rest is all just a bit here and a bit there and making do with scraps. It's a very bad day and a very bad set of decisions.
On the other hand, John Tewser, one does have to ask, what are the alternatives? Because as we know, the finances of Britain generally are in a terrible state and everybody is having to make cuts in just about every public service.
Well, except the Department for International Development. Are you really telling me that the World Service does less for capacity building, which DFID always talks about? I think it's doing more for capacity building in many parts of the world. It's doing more for gender awareness and all the other things that Diffitt says it's doing. It simply is extraordinary to preserve the international aid budget and then to axe so much of the World Service. Six services last time, five languages of service this time, and 570 editorial staff. It is hollowing out the editorial capacity and the journalistic capacity of the BBC. No amount of messing around at the edges can alter that fact. It's a very bad day.
OK, let's get Louise Bagshaw's reaction to that.
Oh, you make it sound as though the World Service is about to be closed by the Foreign Office. We're talking about real-term spending only pruning back to 2008 levels. 3.5 million people at the moment are listening to the five language services which are being shut. That's out of a total World Service audience of 180 million people.
And so this is not a...
It is not a doomsday scenario.
Going to be able to hear the World Service. 30 million by Peter. You know, what is the Foreign Office doing walking away from an audience of 30 million? All this, you know, a bit of this and a bit of that. You're trying to micromanage broadcasting. It's never worked in the past, and it doesn't work now.
Louise Bagshaw, that is true. It is 30 million, we just heard Peter Horrocks said, who will not be able to hear the programmes they have been hearing.
I have the figure in front of me from the Foreign Secretary, which is 3.5 million, so there's a massive disparity there. But I will say that you've heard Peter Horrocks say on this very programme that the core mission of the World Service will not be touched. We have seen the Director General.
You are axing it in all sorts of ways. You're depriving audiences. You're saying you can get through on the internet. There is no substitute to large.
We're talking about shortwave radio nonsense. These are services which are blocked and which people don't listen to.
And on your attitude, we would have stopped broadcasting to the Soviet Union during the Cold War because there was jamming. What sort of idiocy, I'm sorry to use the word, it's not personal, what sort of idiocy is that?
But I'm afraid this is fighting yesterday's battles today. Back in that time, there was not the availability of the internet.
You can't micromanage as you're trying to do.
Louise Bagshaw, would you just answer his charges there, that you're micromanaging?
I will indeed. We have, after all, made this settlement with the chairman of the BBC Trust, the Director General of the BBC today in the Telegraph defended these changes.
Okay.
You've heard Peter Horrocks defend them. The BBC is in favour of them.
And that was Conservative MP Louise Bagshaw. And I was also talking to the former BBC boss, John Tewser. And we did ask several times for the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, to come on the programme to talk about all of this, but he declined.
Foreign Minister William Hague declined to come on the programme. I wonder why. Now, I want to talk for a moment about some of the statements made by MP Louise Bagshaw. While they are not lies, they are completely inaccurate. At one point, she said that people in China can easily access, or rather, have an easier time accessing BBC World Service programming via the internet. This is true, and it isn't true. If you go to major centers like Beijing and Shanghai, yes, many Chinese will use proxy service to access websites that are blocked by the Chinese government. But these are not foolproof. By Chinese law, issued by the Ministry of Information and Technology and the State Administration of Film, Radio, and Television, internet cafes must also provide another firewall to make sure that people in the internet cafes don't access proxy servers to access websites that are blocked. And I can give you a good example. On my last trip to China, I visited Heilongjiang province. And I wanted to see what was going on in one of the internet cafes. And the reason was my hotel apparently had no internet connection. They said it was down for technical reasons after they found out that I was a journalist. Anyway, doesn't matter. That's neither here nor there. So I went to one of the internet cafes and checked my email. That worked fine. I then wanted to find out what was going on in the rest of the world. So I used the proxy server that I normally access. Well, it was blocked. Yes, they even blocked the proxy server. And the only foreign websites that I was able to access were for checking email and entertainment websites. Everything else was blocked. Blocked like you wouldn't believe. But that night, I did manage to turn on my shortwave receiver and listen to the BBC World Service in English, and then went to the Chinese frequency, and yes, there was jamming, but there are ways to go around the jamming. It just makes you wonder who made these decisions and what was the reason for making them. Are they trying to get brownie points from the Chinese Communist Party? It makes you wonder. In the last few months, there have been two large trade missions that have went to Britain and the United States. And oddly, again, I'm not doing any conspiracy thoughts here, but it's raising questions, because as they say, where there's smoke, there's fire. There was a big trade mission that went to London, and then contracts were signed worth millions and millions of pounds, and then this happened. So you kind of wonder if Britain was pressured into making this decision. The BBC and other organizations have said that the Chinese service has around 500,000 listeners in China. I would like to know how they calculate that. Because other estimates put it in the millions that listen to the BBC World Service off shortwave. Getting accurate information about who's listening on shortwave in China is very difficult. In many regions of the country where there are tighter government controls and the Public Security Bureau is more busy at tracking down people listening to foreign radio, people are not going to openly admit listening to the Voice of America or the BBC. So the figure of 500,000 makes me wonder where that came from. Now let's stay on this subject, but with another radio station. Last week, the Voice of America said that the Obama administration has proposed cuts to the VOA, but not for budgetary reasons. They are going to be cutting all Chinese programming, radio and television. Oddly enough, this came just a few weeks after Chinese President Hu Jintao was in Washington on a trade mission to discuss economic ties with the United States. Some people have said that this is very short-sighted and that the Obama administration was pressured into it. I don't know, because we don't have any proof of that, but it just makes you wonder. The VOA has a number of frequencies to China on shortwave. And yes, just like with the BBC, the Chinese authorities try to jam them. But unfortunately, the jamming is not very effective and there are ways to go around it. And it's a lot easier to go around a jammed radio signal than it is to log on to a website that is blocked, even with a proxy server. Over the past few years, we've seen the VOA, the BBC, and other international broadcasters cut down on broadcasts. And then they will say, well, we have to cut shortwave completely because nobody is listening. Well, it's sort of like the chicken and the egg effect. If you have 10 frequencies and you cut it down to 2, it makes it, of course, more difficult for people to find you. And then, of course, they will stop listening. China, on the other hand, has been expanding in HF at a dramatic rate. It is quite amazing when you think about it. Now, they're not just expanding on HF, but at the moment in the United States, they have over 60 relays of their programming on local radio stations. Is the VOA offered this courtesy in China? No. Is the BBC offered this courtesy in China? No. But China is going around the world buying up airtime on local radio stations and putting out their own propaganda. And who's getting the short end of the stick? The VOA and the BBC and the West. So, listen, guys, I don't know about you or where you came up with these decisions, but don't you think there's a problem here? Don't you think that maybe you should be strengthening broadcasts to China? Or don't you care anymore? And my feeling is that the people that are running international broadcasting today have no idea of the countries that these stations broadcast to. They have no idea the hurdles that people have to go to get reliable and accurate information to draw their own conclusions about their own governments. This is my feeling about it. Now, I should mention at this point that the cuts that are proposed to the VOA are just that. They're just a proposal. If it goes through Congress and Senate, well, we will have to wait and see. As for the BBC World Service, there is a very active campaign to put pressure on the Foreign Office, including a hearing at the Committee of Foreign Relations, to discuss the cuts of the BBC and the impact that it would have on the United Kingdom. If you wish to make your comments known to a certain Louise Bagshaw, please do so. I have written once. I got a reply back from her secretary saying that Miss Bagshaw would reply shortly. I'm still waiting for that to happen. But if you wish to make your comments known, because I'm sure they're getting to her, her email address is Louise, Louise, .Bagshaw, Bagshaw, .MP, @parliament.uk. That's Louise.Bagshaw.MP @parliament.uk. If you didn't have time to write that down, just go to the Media Network Plus page and you will find the link there.
This is Media Network Plus.
March 4th and 5th shortwave listeners from the U.S., Canada, and other parts of the world will be gathering in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, for the annual SWL Winter Fest. After 24 years, this is the first time the festival won't be held in Culpsville. Richard Cuff is one of the organizers, and he tells us next about this year's festival and the reason for switching location.
We moved approximately 10 miles down the road this year to Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, still one of the northern suburbs of Philadelphia and adjacent to regional highways, as well as Philadelphia's public transit system. We switched this year in part because the hotel where we'd held the fest had a change of ownership, and they have been going through a renovation and upgrade. And for us to return to that hotel would have required a cost increase. And we felt that ways to identify value and to try to keep the costs reasonable for Fest participants would be worth the slight inconvenience of having to change locations.
Now, this year's festival, I suppose the tone is going to be very different, because in the past 6 months, we've seen a number of stations go off the air, and announced cuts that they were going off the air. Was the cuts at the BBC and others, was this a surprise to you as one of the organizers, and have you decided to discuss that this year?
I mean, this continues a trend that started, oh gosh, back in the 1990s, depending on where you want to draw the line. The BBC, of course, was one of the most notable broadcasters to begin a de-emphasis on shortwave back in 2001. July 1st was the date that year where they limited the broadcast specifically targeting North America. And as a result, there's been a gradual de-emphasis on shortwave utilization by broadcasters, including the handful this past year. To some extent, we continue to call the fest the SWL Fest almost out of laziness more than anything else. Over the past several years, we have brought in various topics for discussion that take us beyond the very narrow definition of shortwave that characterized the fest in the early years. You know, this year, for instance, we will have some forums that look at such matters as producing your own programming and how you can use just a simple computer to go ahead and put together a program that could either be podcast, of course, or just aired on pirate radio on shortwave. Such matters as traveling to St. Helena. Joe Buck, one of the longtime Fest participants, actually sailed on the QE2 last year from Cape Town, South Africa, and St. Helena was one of the ports of call. And that was a big thing for St. Helena, and for Joe to be someone who knew of St. Helena via the Radio St. Helena broadcasts, it'll be an interesting way to see St. Helena through a slightly different lens than we normally think of it. So there, in some ways we become more of a, it's more of a history or a look at the role that shortwave has had over the years. However, the thing that still remains the same is that radio as a medium is still an important medium for many of us, and whether or not it's shortwave or delivered over the internet or even over local community radio, that creates creative opportunities and some interesting areas that we'll be talking about over the fest.
Do you think that, as an example, you were just mentioning this a moment ago, the name of the fest is the SWL Fest. Do you think that maybe keeping that name gives the wrong image to people that may not know about it, and they'll hear the name and go, well, I don't want to participate because it's probably just old stuff?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I don't have a good answer for you on that. Part of the temptation is to say, okay, should we call ourselves the Radio Fest? Should we call ourselves the Shortwave and Internet Media Delivery and Podcast and Local Broadcast and FM Relay Fest?
By the time you get through that name, the festival will be over.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of the problem, because one of the challenges is that you've got media, you've got the material itself, and then you have the delivery platform. And these delivery platforms are what have fragmented and multiplied over the past few years. Your question, does this cause people to decide, nah, this is not for me? Tough to say. I honestly don't have a good answer for that. Like I said, we're kind of lazy, and we've just kept it the SWL Fest over the years, in part to recognize the heritage that we have. One of the things that we've started to do over the years is to, the past couple of years especially, is to inject into the information radio in all its forms, to show to people that, yes, indeed, we're not just shortwave these days. I mean, to that end, we have had scanning, HF scanning and VHF scanning as a component of the fest since its very early days. So to some extent, it's never been 100% shortwave related. I mean, gosh, this is what, year number 24. Probably since year two or three, there's been a specific forum about scanning, and that's not shortwave. Mm-hmm. And, in the classic HF portion of the RF spectrum. So, it's possible. We sit around and talk about, do we change its name? Do we not change its name? We think about it. Then we decide, it's not worth worrying about. And, it's to some extent, this has become obviously a big family reunion. So those that know about the fest come to the fest because they know what to expect. They occasionally will bring friends. A lot that we find out happens just via word of mouth. And our goal has never been to be big. Our goal has really always been to try to be true to those who have been participants in the fest for these 20 some years.
What are some of the regulars? Like, for example, in case somebody doesn't know, I mean, I know what it is, but let's say the shortwave shindig. How would you describe that session?
The shortwave shindig is something that is now probably close to a 10-year component of the fest, maybe something more. David Gorin is a public radio producer and a shortwave fan. He has produced a series of features and documentaries over the years for National Public Radio and other public media. And David is a radio craftsman. His interest is radio and how radio sounds and what radio is. And so David has always been interested in just the diversity of sounds that that shortwave has represented. So what David tends to do is go into his archives of all the audio he saved over the years from various programs and play that. He also mixes in quizzes about shortwave and interval signals. Occasionally we've had someone come in who's a fest regular who is a flautist, and he's gotten together with this flautist ahead of time, and the flautist has played the first few notes of an interval signal, and people guess which station it is. So it's stuff like that. It's a couple of the fest participants are harmonica players and guitar players, so we've got live performances, and it's just an interesting Friday evening into the early morning hours kind of just a sit down and enjoy radio type of setting. It starts normally about 8:30 at night on the Friday and lasts until there's nobody left, pretty much. We tend to take that into the early morning hours. I think some years it's gone as late as 2:30 in the morning. And it's just the kind of thing where we just sit around and in a very reasonably unstructured sense, just chat about radio. It is certainly not the most crowded session because people are always together in their own, getting together for dinner or just conversation because they haven't seen each other for a year. But it's always just a fun time to sit around and listen to and talk about radio.
And if you would like more information on the SWL Winterfest, their website is www.swlfest.com. That's www.swlfest.com. A link to their website will be found at the Media Network Plus page at pcjmedia.com. I also want to take this opportunity to let you know that I'll be taking part in David Garan's Shortwave Shindig on March the 4th, and we're going to be doing a video link from Taipei. You're listening to Media Network Plus.
Here in Canada, the federal government is battling with its licensing agency and the federal courts over allowing a newcomer into the Canadian telecommunications market. On February 4th, the federal court overruled a previous government decision that allowed GlobalLive Wireless Management Corporation, an upstart Canadian wireless operator, to offer mobile services. Then on February 15th, the Harper government announced that it would appeal the court's ruling. We contacted the Honorable Tony Clement, Minister of Industry, to discuss the situation and the impact of this legal skirmish on Canadian wireless consumers.
Well, actually, the first ruling on this was done by Industry Canada, which was then overruled by the CRTC, which in turn was overruled by the federal cabinet. So that's the course of events that led to the court challenge. Our position is very clear. We feel that on a legal basis, the GlobalLive, through its operations in Canada, meets the test under the Telecommunications Act as a not foreign controlled company, that is to say a Canadian company. It does so because most of its shares are owned by Canadians. Its board of directors is not controlled by foreigners. And finally, its day-to-day business management is operated by Canadians. So on all of those tests, it meets the Canadian test and the Canadian standard. What's important is the intention of us moving ahead with GlobalLive, as well as other new market entrants, is to provide Canadians with more choice, more competition, better service, better pricing when it comes to wireless. And that's the whole purpose behind the policy that underlies why GlobalLive is active in the Canadian market, and that's to make sure that Canadians have more choices when it comes to choosing their carrier.
Okay, but that still doesn't really answer the question. What did the CRTC see as foreign ownership that prompted it to deny the license on that basis?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to speak for the CRTC, but my understanding is because GlobalLive accessed foreign capital in order to do their build-out, that this was the thing that they found to be contrary to our laws. When I look at our laws, it's a matter of day-to-day management and control. It's a matter of who's on the board. It's a matter of who owns the shares. And on all of those indicators, the company was Canadian. So there is a disagreement of legal opinion. Our point of view is that we read the law properly, and that's what we're taking to the Superior Court, appealing the federal court lower decision. But I think probably what's more important to know is that the whole basis of why we're in this argument in the first place is not about foreign ownership versus Canadian ownership. What we're trying to do is open up our wireless sector to more competition, more choice, better availability, better service for Canadians who tend to rely on wireless these days. So I think that's the important thing to keep in mind.
Okay, so we don't want to say that it's political, but it actually is political.
It's not political. We're looking at the law based on legal principles, but the principles behind why we're into this argument in the first place is, as a matter of public policy, we believe more competition is better than less competition. More choice for consumers is better than less choice for consumers. And that's what the whole thrust of our opening up new spectrum to new entrants was all about.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read an RCR Wireless report that last October said in Canada, three big players accounted for about 21 million of some 22 million wireless customers.
Mm-hmm.
This in a country of 35 million that has one of the highest cell phone rates, if not the highest, in the world. Now, by contrast, Taiwan, with a population of 22 million living in a space the size of Vancouver Island, has six carriers and a seventh coming on board soon. As a result, Taiwan residents enjoy much better service and considerably lower prices than Canadians. For example, my colleague in Taipei gets G3 service for the equivalent of $18 to $20 Canadian a month, and for an extra $12, he gets internet connectivity for his mobile phone and iPad. Now, in Canada, consumers pay more than double for similar services, probably around $100 a month. Now, your government has stated that it believes competition is good for the Canadian telecommunications industry, as you've just told us. The three big industry players, however, namely Rogers, TELUS, and Bell Canada, disagree. And what's your response to them?
Well, our position is clear. We want to see more competition, more choice. That's why we specifically reserved part of the spectrum that was auctioned 3 years ago for new entrants, that the incumbents, Bell, Rogers, TELUS, were not allowed to even bid on that spectrum, that it was for new entrants. And that's why we have GlobalLive and Mobilicity and Public Mobile and Shaw and Quebecor. They're all in that space now, busy building out their networks and offering service. If we hadn't have reserved spectrum back in 2008 for new entrants, none of this would be possible. So we've taken the right posture on this. We want to see more competition. We want to see more entrants. We want to make sure that Canadians have more choice. And that helps everybody. It actually means that the incumbents have to be sharper in their practices, and I mean that in a positive sense, sharper in the sense that they have to provide better quality at lower prices to Canadians if they want to compete. So I think that that's what we are all about, and that's why I continue to be faithful to that policy.
I was speaking with the Honourable Tony Clement, Canada's Minister of Industry, from his constituency office in Huntsville, Ontario.
And now time for a special message from our secret agent,
004.
Well, Agent 99, did you take that message down?
Yes, I did, James. Or is that Max? Or, well, whatever your cover is today.
To be perfectly honest, Paulette, I'm not really sure. I could even be Colonel Flagg from MASH. Anyway, what is all that about? Well, not too long ago, there's an American journalist here in Taiwan by the name of Wendell Minnick. He writes for a U.S. magazine called Defense Weekly News. And he did a story about a very well-known Chinese number station who identifies themselves as New Star Broadcasting. Now, we talked about number stations before, not just on this program, but on Happy Station. But I thought that at this time, we would look at the backstory. How do you go to find out this information?
Well, I'm interested in anything spooky like that. Number stations had largely been forgotten for a long time because the Cold War was over, and I happened upon a recording on YouTube about some Chinese number stations, and purely by accident, you know, just spooking around the YouTube, looking at things, and found them, and I realized it was a local guy here that recorded it, and I contacted him and did a story.
Now, when you're doing a story on this kind of station, what are the challenges and hoops that you have to go through? Because it's not like an intelligence agency will say, oh yeah, we have a radio station.
Well, yeah, obviously the U.S. intelligence or even the Taiwan intelligence is not going to admit to broadcasting numbers. For one thing, a lot of the folks in the intelligence community here in the Taiwan government didn't know what the hell I was talking about when I did ask about the number stations, and it took a lot of digging to finally get someone to acknowledge that they were doing something in that order. But they also admitted that they weren't sure that the numbers that I'd recorded and played back for them were the same numbers that they're broadcasting. So it's a very compartmentalized system. So, but yeah, the technical issues were a big problem. Just because they're broadcasting numbers doesn't mean they're necessarily spies. I went through a whole host of scenarios. One was fishing boats. We thought maybe that the numbers were being broadcast to fishing boats at sea so that they could strategize on fishing areas, you know, so that the other fishing boats wouldn't know which areas that they were going to fish next. That was killed. That idea was
and
killed.
Then there was Chinese telegraphy.
Yeah, telegraphy was another issue because the Chinese characters, there's so many of them that the numbers represent characters. Like, you know, A is 1, B is 2, C is 3 in the English alphabet. Well, Chinese characters, there are thousands of them. So they assign a 4-digit number to each character. So we assumed it, and they call it the Chinese telegraph code, and we thought that that might be what it is. But the numbers broadcast we got the Chinese telegraph code, and it didn't match the numbers at all. And we got 3 different kinds of Chinese telegraph code, the Hong Kong, Taiwanese, and mainland Chinese telegraph code, and the numbers didn't match. My wife actually transcribed this stuff, matched it up, and said that they didn't. That was a hard job, actually, writing down each number and looking up the Chinese telegraph code. It took a lot of time. It took about a month to write the story.
When you were working on the story, were there any strange things that happened, like maybe people trying to put you off from even talking about it?
I think there were a lot of people who just didn't believe it was still going on, because it was an old Cold War trick. And we have the internet now, and people were saying things like, why would they broadcast numbers when they could simply place a coded message on, let's say, an advertisement, a fake advertisement somewhere, or a fake website, or a blog, and someone could just look it up and get the numbers off there, or get the code off there, or whatever. But that still traces you back to the site. You know, if I get on that site from my home computer, people know that I got on that site. Even if it's a front or some sort of blog or something, the chance of being caught are serious. So, and the other issue is that during a war, they might shut down the internet. The internet might not be working anymore. So the best way to broadcast would be shortwave, mm-hmm. which can't be shut down, really.
So when you were researching it and you met government officials, did you meet people, let's say, from the Ministry of Defense and other departments? And what did they say to you? Did they like look around at each other going, oh, I think we're caught? Or did they try to uncomfortably laugh it off?
There were a lot of puzzled looks. I had to really get the Ministry of National Defense to really dig into it themselves, because they weren't sure what the hell I was talking about. And I had to play it back for them. They finally came back and said that, yeah, that it was a number station, and they were aware of it. They did acknowledge that it did exist, but whether it belonged to the Taiwanese or the mainland Chinese is not clear. I did also attend a meeting with the local Taipei Amateur Radio Club and got their impressions of the broadcast, and they were very positive that it wasn't a fake. That's one of the questions I posed is, Are these numbers being broadcast by some kid in the basement, you know, with his own antenna on the roof? And then they came back adamantly and repeatedly saying no, that these had to be broadcast by a larger transmitter or something that the government would have. So that was one issue that I was concerned about, that it was a fake broadcast.
Now, you write for Defense Weekly News, and you have a lot of interest in these spy stories. I mean, they are very interesting. And there was another place, actually, that people around the world may not know about. It's a place here in Taiwan called Spook Mountain. What is the story with Spook Mountain?
The Signal Intelligence Facility in Yamishan is run jointly by the U.S. National Security Agency and the Taiwanese National Security Bureau. And they monitor Chinese mainland radio traffic. And that facility has been there for about 12 years now. There was one in Hong Kong many years ago during the Cold War, and when that shut down before 97, they just moved it here to pick up the transmissions. They couldn't maintain it in Hong Kong for obvious reasons. So but the facility is run here, and I actually, when I first came here in 97, I was hanging out in a bar, and I ran into some American technicians who were claiming they worked for the phone company, and they were drunk. And then as they got more and more drunk, they talk about being CIA agents to these little girls behind the bar, obviously trying to impress them. But obviously they weren't working for the CIA. They were just technicians working on contract for the National Security Agency and the Taiwanese. But, you know, I drank with them a lot, hung out with them a lot, and I got to know them. And after a while, it just came out. I slowly began to put the pieces together from different ones, from different points, and I finally went up there and photographed the facility, and I did a huge story about it. You know, it was very embarrassing to the U.S. And the Taiwan government. So,
now, when you're doing this kind of story here in Taiwan and you're covering this topic, has it ever happened to you that they will call you and say, we'd rather you kill this story, we'd rather you not report on it? Have you ever received that kind of pressure? And in China, for example, foreign reporters will get this pressure from the Chinese government. What about here in Taiwan?
I never receive pressure from the Taiwan government or the U.S. government not to do a story. They never contact me and say, you kill this thing. I've approached the folks here in the Taiwan Intelligence Service and military about stories I'm writing, just to give them a chance to be aware that, you know, they have to respond to the idea that I'm doing a story in the first place. But they've never asked me to not to do this story or threaten me or anything like that. And the U.S. doesn't really has a policy of not talking about intelligence operations like that. So, you know, I have talked to AIT and some of the military intelligence folks there about.
And AIT, in case nobody knows, is the American Institute here in Taiwan, which is sort of a quasi-embassy.
Yeah, it's basically the U.S. embassy here. And it's got U.S. state, CIA, and U.S. military officers working there. And, you know, I have gone to them and said, look, I'm doing a story on this. I want you to be aware of it. And if you want to give me any of your feedback or anything like that, you're welcome to do so. But you should be aware that, you know, to be fair, ethically as a journalist, I have to notify them that I'm doing a story. So,
Here's another question. I mean, I don't know how much you would know about it, but during the Cold War, West Berlin was known for the spies that were running around West Berlin. Here in Taiwan, during, let's say, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, was this place overrun with spies, let's say, like West Germany was, or West Berlin?
Well, not from China, that's for sure. Most of the spies that came in from China later came when direct contact with the Chinese mainland became more and more open, and that was in the 1990s, and up to now, it's becoming even more open. They have direct flights now back and forth from the mainland, and so interaction, the more interaction you have, the more chance you have for spies. But I would say that Taiwan's military and government is just full of spies, mainland Chinese spies, so they probably pretty much know everything that's going on here.
And I was speaking there with Wendell Minnick, a U.S. journalist based here in Taiwan, talking about the infamous, or now famous, Chinese number station.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus. If you wish to get in touch with us with your story ideas, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. Once again, that is peace, cheer, and joy, pcjmedia@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out our page at the PCJ site to download all past editions of the show. And do feel free to subscribe to the show via iTunes. You can find all the details, once again, at www.pcjmedia.com, www.pcjmedia.com.
And if you're one of those people that's a bit of a masochist and likes bad postal service, you can also send us a letter via snail mail. Our snail mail address is Media Network Plus, PCJ, 8th floor, that's 8th floor, number 4747, Lane, L-A-N-E, 31, Section 1, Sanmin Road, that's S-A-N like Norman, M like Mother, I like Ivan, N like Norman Road, and I'm running out of air, Banqiao, B-A-N-C-I-A-O, Taipei, Taiwan, R-O-C, 22070. If you ask me to repeat it right now, well, I'm not going to, but you can actually find that information where, Paulette?
www.pcjmedia.com.
So for me, Keith Parent in Taipei, Taiwan.
And from me, Paulette McQuarrie in Vancouver, Canada.
We hope to see you all again very, very soon.
Bye for now.
And best 73s to you all.
Goldfinger. He's the man, the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch. Such a cold finger. You to enter his web of sin, but don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you fear. Mr. Goldfinger, pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. Kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl.